this is soccer country now. Even if we trying to, you know, even if we try to underrate it and think that U.S., you know, it will never reach, it's not true. We are growing every year. I've been here since 1980. I saw the NASL up with the stars, with Pelé and Beckenbauer, and I saw them folded. And I saw them many, many years with no league. And I saw then the MLS. And you see how big the MLS is now compared 20 years ago. So it takes time. The people, you know, sometimes they trying to say, hey, the USA will never reach that level. Yes, they will. It's just that it takes time. But this is a great opportunity for us in the US to enjoy soccer this summer.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we talk to a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producers, that would be two on this one, are Alex Apnos and Bette Marston. And the reason we have two producers is because we have two guests for this episode. The first is Fernando Fiore, the Fox Sports soccer host. Very famously worked at Univision for a quarter of a century, hosting their sports shows, known there as El Presidente. Also worked in entertainment there and was part of a travel show with Sofia Vergara. So he's had an interesting career, and now he has come to Fox and will be a big part of their Copa America coverage, which starts on June 3rd and goes throughout the whole month. He'll also be part of their 2018 World Cup coverage, Mexican national team games, and he's a big name in the Spanish language sports media, and that was a good get for Fox. He's a fun guy to watch on TV. You know, he's not your sort of traditional host. He's not Bob Lee or anything like that. He's much more of sort of a voice of the fan guy, but great passion for soccer and a fun guy, and we're glad that he's on this podcast. The second guest for this podcast is Ryan Burr, the host of a Golf Channel host. He does a lot of their live from stuff, so you'll see Ryan Burr at many of the events that the Golf Channel covers for the Rio Olympics. He'll be based in Orlando, being one of the signature hosts covering the golf's return to the Olympics, which should be a pretty huge story for the Olympics. The reason Ryan is on, in addition to his work on the Golf Channel, and he was an ESPN anchor for many years, and we'll talk to him about his experiences at ESPN, is he co-wrote a novel called The Fix, which a college quarterback gets involved in some gambling issues in the underbelly of college football. And I thought it was just really interesting that a sports broadcaster delved into a different content play and co-wrote a novel. So we'll ask him about his novel as well as his time at ESPN. He was there before the latest, I'd say the sort of all the changes that you've seen in terms of talent. So I think he could provide some interesting analysis on that. My thanks to you guys for listening to some of the previous podcasts. Sean McDonough, Adnan Burke, closing in on 100,000 downloads. So thank you very much for listening there. John Oran was the last one doing some sports media nerd talk. And so this should be interesting. Two guys with very different careers and two different sports, but I think you'll enjoy it. So we're going to start with Fernando Fiore and then finish up with Ryan Burr. All right, and as promised from beautiful Los Angeles, we bring in the now Fox Sports broadcaster, Fernando Fiore. Fernando, thank you for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and good morning, because it is morning where you are and afternoon where we are.
Yes. Good morning. How you doing? I'm trying to get used to myself because I'm from the other coast also. So I'm trying to get used to this 3 hour difference, and I'm pretty happy. This is a great place to be. LA is a wonderful city, and I never had a chance to live here. I used to live in New York, and now I live in Miami. So this is a great place to experiment for this next month.
This is a very big tournament that you are going to be part of, the Copa America. Fox Sports 1, FX, has these games. And it's really an incredible summer of soccer when you add the Euros as well. You, Fernando, came to Fox last October, made your English language debut for the U.S.-Mexico men's national team CONCACAF match. And so I want to ask you a couple questions sort of just from your move from Univision to Fox. And first off, how would you describe your broadcasting style to an English-speaking audience that has not seen much of you?
I love the first question. Let me tell you, and I think this is a great introduction for El Presidente, and that's the nickname I received in the last 15 years. I always tell everybody that I'm not trying to know more than the people I'm talking to. It's funny that I would say in the last 25 years, many times the people think that the ones that we are on TV, the analysts, we need to know more. I think it's enough people on TV that they have a great knowledge of our soccer from either they used to be a players or used to be coaches, and or people that they want to analyze every single move of the players on the pitch. My style is completely different, Richard. I'm completely different of all of them. I know soccer, yes, very much so, because I play soccer all my life, so I know the rules and I know how to play, and I'm still playing at 55.
Nice.
Do I know soccer because I read? Yes, I read about million of topics about soccer, and did I go to places to learn about soccer? Yes, I went to every single country that hosted at one point the World Cup. So I have a lot of knowledge, but my style is completely different. I'm a fan from the stand that have the chance to be in front of a microphone. I'm trying to be that voice, that link from the million of people that they are watching a soccer game, either from the stands or, you know, from TV, and they don't have the voice. They want to say something that probably is not so analytical. People that watches, you know, John Doe or Juan Perez that watches soccer, they don't really analyze if it's a, all the time, if it's a 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1, they got two guys on the side, but then when they cross over, usually the changes and the coaches, they just watch the game. They watch and enjoy the beautiful game. They see some things that, you know, that they like or don't like. And that's my voice, and that's my style. And I don't pretend to know more than my colleagues, and I don't pretend to know less than my colleagues. I just like to enjoy the game, and that's my style. I don't know if it's a particular name for that, but I'm a fan. I'm a fan of soccer, and I'm trying to be that missing link.
Fernando, when you are broadcasting in English versus when you are broadcasting in Spanish, as you did for so many years at Univision, are you a different broadcaster? Do you approach things differently when you are talking to an English-speaking audience primarily versus a Spanish-speaking audience? And if so, what's the difference?
At this moment, I don't. No. I usually just give my opinion, and it could be, you know, it could be a little sarcastic sometimes. It could be a little ironic sometimes. It could be, you know, a little too straightforward sometimes, but I did the same in Spanish and English. But, and here is a but, and it's always a but. The big difference here is that, unfortunately, people that, you know, are listening to you and watching you on TV, they want to hear that you say that their team is the best, even if they lost 4-0. And you know, it happens in Spanish or in English. If you are talking about in the World Cup and you say that Paraguay didn't play good or Bolivia, you know, is not making any moves, I say, hey, what are you talking like that about my country, you know? And I say, well, because, you know, you lost 4-0. What do you want me to say, that you play good? No, well, but you shouldn't say that. So I think it's going to be the same thing in Spanish and English. And if I have to say something in English that, you know, that the people don't like, probably they will do the same. So it's a little difficult when you are giving your opinion about national teams or clubs. You know, people tend to, you know, to completely get blind when their teams are playing. They don't want to hear they're bad.
Fernando, when I talked to you a couple months ago, you said something interesting to me. We were talking a little bit about the adjustment that you have to make at Fox, because now everything off camera is English versus Spanish. And you said that it would be a shock for your brain cells, but you have to get used to it very fast. And you said, it's not that I don't use the language, but I will have to adjust to working on air in a different language, which was really interesting to me, because for so many years, you're getting direction from producers and stage managers in Spanish. Now, when you're working for Fox, I presume that that stuff is all going to be in English. So how is that? That's a big adjustment. So how is that adjustment going?
Should I laugh in English or in Spanish?
Both. It's a bilingual podcast.
Still a shock. Still a shock for my brain cells. You will be surprised. It's not a big difference in terms of the producers and the stage manager and so on, because usually the guys that do that in the Spanish networks, usually they give you directions in English many times. Mm. So it's not a big difference into that. I think that the more games I'm doing, and I felt it. I felt it last weekend when we did USA versus Bolivia. Every time I go in front of the camera now in English, it's getting easier and easier. My brain cells are adjusting much better. In terms, like I said before, last time we talked, in terms of, okay, now we have to say something in English that usually we don't say like that in Spanish. So it takes a little time. But I guess it's getting better and better every game. And I'm pretty sure it will be the same thing during the Copa America. Probably, you know, it will take me one or two games. But I felt that it's getting better every time, you know, the camera goes on now. So I don't feel any difference, and I think that my brain is adjusting pretty well.
You made, if I'm correct about this, you made your English language debut last October for the U.S.-Mexico game that I cited, the CONCACAF Cup match. You have been in broadcasting a long time, but I wonder, how nervous were you before that match?
I'm always nervous. It doesn't matter if it's in English and Spanish or in Chinese. I thank God every day that I'm going in front of the camera with, you know, a level of adrenaline that it, you know, you can call them, I'm nervous, you can call them anxiety, you can call it whatever it is, but I don't relax in English, in Spanish, or in any language. Every time I go in live, I still, after 25 years in front of the cameras and after 25 years of confronting sometimes live 100,000 people at the Dallas Stadium, and still get the chills. I love that. I don't want to relax. I don't want to be comfortable with it. I don't want to be taking it for granted. Oh no, I can do that because I already did it for 25 years. No, I don't. I'm very honest. very straightforward. I'm still got that little thing inside me every time I'm gonna go live, and I love it, and I thank God for that.
Fernando, what have you found to be the biggest difference between Fox Sports and Univision in terms of approach, in terms of colleagues, in terms of however you want to define it?
I haven't sit down and you know, usually I don't like to compare. I like to look forward. I had a great run in Univision. It was 25 years of my life, pretty much half of my life, and I met people that I get along better than the others, and usually, you know, it was a smooth ride. I could say that 25 years, a very smooth ride, and I left thanking everybody, and I left saying goodbye to my audience, which is sometimes it's not very easy, in national broadcast. Usually, you know, I saw many of my colleagues having to leave without even say goodbye to the audience, and that, you know, it's a sad departure. So for me, it was completely different. I thought that I finished, you know, something in my life that lasted 25 years, quarter of a century, and like I said, I don't look back. I don't look back, and I don't try to find differences. I try to find all the good things that I have now with Fox, and I'm looking forward, and I have great memories from my past, adventure, and I'm looking forward, and I don't see a lot of differences right now. I mean, I'm trying to learn the styles of Rob Stone and Alexi and Brad Friedel and Eddie Guidalda, and I know these guys for many, many years, but I never worked with them. I used to interview Lalas and Winalda, and so now I'm trying to learn their style, and I'm trying to, to mend with them, and I try to, to be a compliment. Usually the best way for me to interact with your colleagues, for example, is to, learn their style, and then you get into it, and everything will flow. So I don't try to impose my style. I don't try to be different either. I'm just trying to see when can I be Fernando Fiore and at the same time respect the time of everybody else. So it's the same thing that I did before. I learned one day, and this is something that I heard from a lady in the Spanish world, that she was a fantastic performer, and she was used to have her own show all the time with her name. So she was very famous for many, many years. And she always said, the show bears my name. I'm the first figure of the show. But I like everybody to shine, the ones that are around me, because that is the only way that I can shine. Hmm. And I thought it was perfect. I mean, this is something that, I always think about that. You try and you try to, to be able to see that everybody shines, and that's the best way. And I lead the show for 15 years with República Deportiva before, and I was El Presidente, and the show, I was taking the heavy load of the show, but I always was trying to do that. I was trying to make everybody shine, and that's the way I like to work on TV.
Who nicknamed you the president? Who nicknamed you El Presidente?
Yeah, that was in the very beginning of the show. We were developing República Deportiva. It was the very first promo for the show, and a friend of mine that we wanted to do the show together on air, but he was in promotions at that time. He goes, well, this is a República Deportiva Sports Republic. We need a president. So we did a promo, just, making fun that I was a president, and I was starting a new show, and I stick, and it's very difficult because you can make a nickname for, for any player or any coach or any, broadcaster, and you might hit it or not. But it was funny because the first 2-3 weeks on the air, and then every time I was going to Miami Beach or any restaurant, it was, oh, El Presidente is here. Yeah, you have a table for El Presidente. hey, Mr. Presidente. So it really hit, and it was good because the name of the show was Sports Republic, and we needed a president.
Nice.
So it worked out.
Nice.
The funny thing is that I left Univision. I left the show that we created in 1999, and they still run the show. They still call them Sports Republic, but they don't have Presidente anymore. So I don't know.
Someone's going to have to take. They're going to need a coup. Some president's going to have to take over, basically.
I don't know. They kept the name, but they didn't have a new presidente.
Right. That's funny. You mentioned that when you were at the Univision, you interviewed Alexi Lalas, now your colleague. Is Alexi Lalas a good interview subject?
Oh yes. We have a lot of things in common because besides our passion for soccer, I used to play his position at one time in my career. In my career with my friends, right. On Saturdays, I used to play his position, the center back.
Right.
And also because we both love rock and roll to the max. He got a new record now.
Yeah, I heard it. Yep.
So it's funny. I just went to see Paul Simon here in Hollywood Bowl, and I love rock and roll. We can talk a lot about that. Through my life, I've seen pretty much, I guess, over 400 or 500 concerts, rock concerts in around the world. So we always chat a little bit about rock and singing singing rock and roll songs. So we have a lot of things to chat. And this week was Alexi's birthday, so it was fun. I think that he's a good subject, very good subject, and we can explore more things about his soccer and his rock and roll career.
Where you said you've seen 400 to 500 concerts in your life. What's the most obscure place you've seen a rock and roll show?
Well, I remember once, and this is something that a friend of mine always reminds me. We were in Germany, and we stay in Frankfurt. And I remember it was a band that it was famous in the 80s, the Hooters. It was a band from Philadelphia.
Right.
Some of the guys, I don't know if you remember, but a couple of the guys from that band were really good producers. And then they work as a producer for Cyndi Lauper and wrote some songs from her. That band, the Hooters, pretty much disappeared. And by the time that we were in Germany in 2005, nobody remembered that band. They were just doing... a little gigs in Germany, and I told my friends, you know what, the Hooters, and I said, they what? We don't know this band. I said, yes, I know them. I saw them live in 1982, and they were really good, and they have good songs. Go with me to Mainz. Mainz was about an hour away from where we were at right then, and he goes, okay, I go with you. So we went to Mainz. We drove all the way. And the show was in a little hangar. It was really nothing. It was people standing. The band was playing. And the funny thing, and my friend always reminds me that, is that after the two songs, all the German people, they knew the first two songs because they were the more famous. Everybody just shut up. And I was singing alone. I was the only one singing alone all the songs because I knew the lyrics of all the songs. So my friend goes, Fernando is the most crazy rock and roller, goes to any extent to see anything, and he knows all the songs. And it was funny because I was happy. I saw the band that I liked. I drove back an hour from Mainz to where we stay. And I was in between, I think it was in between of the Confederations Cup in 2005 in Germany. So I always mix soccer and rock and roll.
I love it. Great story. You were born in Buenos Aires, and at 19, you moved to the United States on a cold March day.
Yes.
And you eventually went to school at Montclair State. So I wonder, yes, there has to be a story in terms of how does a 19-year-old kid who was born in Buenos Aires end up in New Jersey attending a school there?
Yeah. Do you have a 3-4 days? Or
yeah, let's go. I'm letting the tape run.
No. I do. You see, I'm adapting very well to the English language. Let's do to make the long story short. my family moved from Uruguay. I'm the only Argentinian in my family.
Oh, wow.
It was my father and myself. My mother and all my mother's family, which is the ones that I have, because my father was an only kid, so I have no family from his side. So my mother's family moved to New Jersey, to Hoboken, middle of 1966 or 67, and some of them were there for a while. So at one point, when I was in Argentina with my mother, we were living there. My parents were divorced, and we decided to try, to go, reunite with the family in United States. I was the first one in my family who got to university in Argentina. So everybody was proud of me, and I was proud, and I wanted to be my family, make my family proud. So I got to university in Argentina, but it was a lot of turmoil of those years. It was the military junta, and I didn't have a lot of support from the family because my family wasn't there. So I say, well, if I have to study and work, why not try in the U.S.? And that was it. It was a leap of faith. It was a leap of faith. I didn't have the problem that many immigrants have, and in terms of arriving, I came to U.S. Very nice, like you said, cold day in March. But I had already my apartment with my mother. My family was living here, and the whole building was my family. So it was a crazy, crazy situation for us. It was very funny, very funny stuff. I can write a book about it. We have a building that in Hoboken, New Jersey. Hoboken back then in the 80s is not the Hoboken that we know now. Very, very preppy and very, would say expensive.
Hipster town.
Was the middle class blue collar. So we have the whole building. My cousins were living fourth, third, second floor, and I was even in the basement with my family. So you can imagine screaming to each other, "Hey, George, bring me down the butter!" And and say, "Hey, it's too hot. Bring down the temperature." It was funny Italian style family, and then I started to study English because I couldn't speak, but back then also in Hoboken, it was a lot of Hispanic people, so I could move around, but I wanted to learn. And it was a lucky situation that they offered me to go to Montclair State College. It was college back then, now it's a university, for a special project that it was called Weekend College, where you can take all the subjects in Spanish at the same time you were learning English. So you can do the general requirements in Spanish, so you wouldn't waste your time learning the English first and then start your career. So that was it. And I had a great time.
That's really interesting. That's a fascinating leap of faith. Just one thing, because this time, I've been to Buenos Aires, and this time in Argentina really interests me. And obviously it was a troubling time, but the time that you left was, in the middle of what they call the dirty war, basically, when the, essentially a period of state-sponsored terrorism, that would be my phrase, in Argentina. Did you experience, or did your family experience any fear when you were younger? At 19, you would have obviously been too old for the government to remove kids. But, Fernando, as you know, the stories that come out of there of little kids being removed from their families, it's horrific to read.
Yes, I did. I did. When I was 17, it was 2 years, exactly 2 years before I came to U.S. I was going back from my girlfriend's house to the main avenue to grab some transportation to go back to my home, and it was pretty late. I was walking by myself, and then all of a sudden a car stopped in front of me. Those famous cars that they were back then on those years. It was a Ford, and they literally trying to grab me and put me inside the car, and I put my hands on top of the roof of the car and say, hey, I have my IDs, because usually that was the problem back then. Thanks to my mother and my father. My mother mainly, she always told me, don't leave the house without the ID. Remember, at 17, we already have IDs from 15. Something completely different that people in the United States will never get, understand. But we're going out, every single time with ID, since you are pretty much 13 or 14, because they wanted to know who you were. And that was the rule, So when I put the hands on top of the roof, I prevent myself to go inside the car, which probably will make it more difficult to get out, and I probably will disappear, So I put my hands on top of the roof and say, hey, I have an ID. So they stop and they let me reach my ID, and they look and they make some questions what I was doing and this and that, and thank God they let me go.
Wow.
I was really scared. Of course, I didn't tell anything to my mother because I was the only child also, and that would make it very difficult for her to let me get out of the house after that. Remember, at that time, 15, 16, 17, you were still a kid back in the 80s. that was the worst case scenario for me at that time, and I was very lucky, thank God. And I have a friend of mine that he was with me in grammar school, that he disappeared very early. He was involved, in some organizations, and he disappeared.
Wow.
So it's a tragic story. Another guy that was working in the food market that we knew it every day. He used to sell meat, and we know the guy very well. And then one of a sudden one day he disappeared. And you know, those things they were very common, unfortunately. And thousands of people disappeared at that time. So it's a very sad part of our story. It's something that obviously we're never ever gonna forget. And and it, you know, talking right now, I'm still feel very sad about it. So yeah. it was some of those little things were decisions that we decided to leave the country also.
Yeah, I appreciate you telling me that. I can only imagine just how horrible and scary that was for a young kid.
It was.
And that was just a bad time in Argentina. We'll segue dramatically as we finish up here with Fernando to the Copa America, because the tournament now that's coming up, you're going to have a very big role, Fernando, in terms of hosting. I think it's called Copa America Tonight, which will be pre and post game, or a lot of post game shows. And so the as you know, in this country, ESPN really got a lot of praise for how they've handled the post game of the World Cups with the very kind of low key style and conversation after the games, particularly in Germany and Brazil. And people really liked just how they, how they talked about the games, and it was much more relaxed than your traditional post game show. So I'm wondering, for the Copa this month, how do you see that? How do you see Copa tonight? What kind of feel will soccer fans get from this show?
Completely different than the one they're used to. I'm really happy. I'm looking forward. It's a great opportunity. I have to thank David Neal and the people from Fox to give me this opportunity. I will be, you know, co-hosting a show that it will be late at night. Right after the game, it will be probably the post game, that it will be short, usually because we have something else, another property coming up, and so you got a couple of highlights and maybe a couple of opinions, and that's it. But then Copa tonight will be a night during the show, and we can give you later the date, so you can go in and tune in, but it will be 9 nights, starting with Friday, and it will be you know a few hours after the last whistle, so we will have time to digest, and then again that will be what I like to do most, which is a fan analysis of what happened during the games. So for me, it will be completely different. It will be something that I've been doing in Spanish for so long. And I will try to see if the general market likes it. And it's a test. I think that for what I see so far, a lot of people like that style. It's just that they don't have the offer. So we will try. We're gonna be with Ali Wagner. We will be with Alexi Lalas pretty much every single of those 9 nights. And then we have different people coming to the shows. It will be Hercules Gomez. It will be Stu Holden. It will be John Strong, if he's here one day, or Grant Wall. So we have different opinions in a different style. I think it will be something new, something that the people will enjoy. And I will bring my style, which is sometimes is a little crazy, I know. But then again, the fans in the stadiums are a little crazy. And sometimes they like to, they like to have their jerseys on. They like to have their craziness a little bit out. Everything with measure, but you have to let it go a little bit. We are not all analysts. We are all not broadcasters. People in the stands like me, we are fans, and I want them to have a voice, and that's what we will be doing in Copa tonight.
Fernando, this tournament is very fair to say the biggest tournament on U.S. soil since the 1999 World Cup, the Women's World Cup. The U.S. does not, generally speaking, get these kind of national teams at their best. in this kind of depth to these shores. So when you take a look at this tournament and you see Argentina and Chile and Brazil and the U.S., how do you think, and you, again, you've lived in Miami for a long time, so I think you have a pretty good sense of how soccer plays in this country. How do you think this tournament is going to do in terms of maybe breaking past the hardcore soccer fan into attracting casual sports fans?
Well, I think that just, let's see, to start with all this, when you have a when you have a big tournament like this, and remember, nowadays for the last many years, we have one big tournament or two or three every summer. So usually people have to make choices and decide, well, should I attend these games? Should I watch these games? Is that important games? So get out of the World Cup, which is every 4 years and everybody knows it. Then this one is something that it really hits close to our homes. Like you said, this is the first time that it will be in our stadiums. So a lot of people that even don't follow soccer like crazy every single weekend, they will have, in many cases, games played very close by. These are big stadiums, a lot of chances to go to see good games. And then you have the star power, which is undeniable. You know, even if you don't know much about soccer, back, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, if you hear that Beckham will be around somewhere, you will go and get a ticket or you will turn on the TV to watch him. And that was David Beckham. He never won a World Cup. He never, you know, get with England very far in the tournament. So now if you hear that Messi is going to be here, which was in the final 2 years ago, that Suarez, the guy who just won everything with Barcelona and make 50 goals, 50-something goals, 59, will be here. If you hear that, you know, that, oh, my God, James Rodriguez, this guy, everybody's talking about this guy. He was one of the best on the World Cup 2 years ago. So even if you are not a diehard fan of soccer, you will notice that the people will pay attention to this. And I think that will be a big difference for the people that don't follow soccer, like, you know, like a, like crazy every weekend. They will pay attention. They will read about it, except in the USA Today, that I'm always trying to find something about soccer in USA Today, and I never found anything. But usually, you open the LA Times 2 days ago, and you have all the, you know, all the teams, and you get involved, and you have the schedule of the games, and I'm sure it's happening the same thing with you know, with newspapers around the country. So it will be a lot of attention. I'm sure that it will bring a lot of fans that are not used to follow soccer every week, and I'm glad for that, because this is soccer country now. Even if we trying to, you know, even if we try to you know, to underrate it and think that U.S., you know, it will never reach, it's not true. We are growing every year. I've been here since 1980. I saw the NASL up with the Stars, with Pelé and Beckenbauer, and I saw them folded. And I saw then many, many years with no league, and I saw then the MLS. And you see how big the MLS is now compared 20 years ago. So it takes time. The people, you know, sometimes they're trying to say, hey, the USA will never reach that level. Yes, they will. It's just that it takes time. But this is a great opportunity for us in the U.S. to enjoy soccer this summer.
All right, final two for me. First, you want to offer a prediction as to who you think is going to win the Copa America?
Argentina.
Homer pick, but a legitimate pick on that. And then finally, you're someone who's covered, I think you told me this the last time, I want to say, is it like 10 World Cups or something? No, okay, 8 World Cups? You've covered a lot of World Cups, right?
Seven. Seven World Cups. This will be my sixth Copa America, and that will be phenomenal, because I remember every single moment from 2001 in Colombia, 2004 in Peru, 2007 in Venezuela, 2011 in Buenos Aires, 2015 in Chile, and now I have 2016 Copa America Centenario here. So. Believe me, Richard, I remember every single tournament in all those countries that I mentioned, and I remember the games, and I remember the finals, and I remember goals, and I remember situations. So I'm really proud. This is going to be the sixth Copa America, and it will be fantastic. And hopefully, finally, I will see Argentina lift the trophy.
Well, that leads me to this question. In all your years of watching World Cups and Copas and great international tournaments, what's the single individual best game you've ever seen?
It didn't happen yet. It didn't happen yet. I'm always looking forward to the next game. I'm always looking forward for the next game. I have a lot of great memories of matches, but the best game didn't happen yet.
All right. Well, if you're not going to answer that, tell me the best play.
Tell me
the best player you've ever seen live. Then.
I can answer. I remember a lot of great games. For example, World Cup, 2014, July 9th. It was my birthday, and Argentina was playing Holland.
Right.
And I said, "Come on, guys, give me the pass to the final in my birthday," and it was great. It was the penalty kicks and Romero. Was a hero, like Mascherano told him before the penalty kicks, and he says, "You're going to be a hero today." And I was very close. I was on that side of the field, and I saw the penalty kicks really close, and it was my birthday. I lost my plane that it was going from São Paulo to Rio because the extra times and the penalties. So I had to took a bus from 6 hours. I was happy, you know, in a bus going back to Rio, and it was a great night. So I will remember that game for the longest time, but it was not a trophy night. So you see, I'm still looking for seeing Argentina like I did in 1978, but I didn't attend the final game because I didn't have money to buy a ticket. So I watched it on TV.
Right. Passarella, Kempis. That's the 78 team, right?
The 78, that was, oh my God. I remember that. I watched, you know, this is another funny story. I watched, my mother, you know, was so kind and so, you know, hardworking, and she got enough money to buy me tickets to see the games in a giant screen. That was the most we can afford because the tickets were too expensive. So I was going every game to watch it in a giant screen. With a lot of people. It was in Luna Park, which was an arena, an old arena that we can watch the games. But the final was a different price. And again, we didn't buy the final ticket. So I watched the final in my little apartment in Buenos Aires in a 12-inch TV, black and white. And and that's the best memory that I have. That's the best game I ever attended. Not in the stadium, but in a nice little 12-inch TV that I bought a couple of years ago in New York, and that was the best moment. So,
nice.
You know, sometimes you don't have to be at the stadium to watch the best game.
Yeah, no doubt about that. All right, Fernando Fiore has been our guest. He is you will see him on FS1 during the Copa America tournament, which starts any day now, as we're taping this, I believe, on June 2nd. And the Copa starts, Alex, when does the Copa start? June 3rd?
Yeah, tomorrow.
June 3rd, starts tomorrow, exactly.
June 3rd, yeah.
I literally just wrote 2,500 words on this. How do I not know that? It starts June 3rd, and you'll see Fernando throughout the month on FS1, including hosting Copa America tonight. He will be a big part of Fox's coverage over the next 3 years. He signed with them, so you'll see him on Mexican national team games. You'll obviously see him at the 2018 World Cup, and he'll be a huge part of their coverage. And for any of the Spanish-speaking soccer fans who are listening to this podcast, you already know Fernando Fiore from his work in Univision. Fernando, listen, this is the second time I've talked to you. It was just as enjoyable, and I hope we can do it again. I really appreciate you coming on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
For me, it's a great pleasure, and I leave you with this this little thing in the era of social networks. It was funny because when I was listening to you right now, and say if you speak Spanish, you know him for many years. It was the other day. It was a tweet of a person that I don't know at all. It's not my cousin. It's not my friend. He put a tweet saying, "I never knew about this Fernando Fiore guy But for the last 5 minutes, I've been listening to him, and he's my favorite analyst. So I thought it was super funny because he was very, very straightforward. I don't know who this Fernando Fiore is, and I never knew about him. But now I'm his favorite. So there you go. I'm trying to live to that level and trying to be the voice of the fan.
Nice.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for everything. God bless you guys.
Yeah, thank you, Fernando. Get on Alexi's case for us, please. And thank you very much.
I will.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Fernando. Take care. After Golden State's incredible Game 7 victory over Oklahoma City in the Western Conference Finals, it's now Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and the rest of the Warriors against LeBron James, Kyrie Irving, and the rest of the Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. That is a rematch of last year, and two people who will be watching every minute of this series will be Ben Golliver and Andrew Sharp of Sports Illustrated. They'll have all the top storylines ready for your morning commute on the Open Floor, which is SI's NBA podcast. So that's Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast. Find it on SI.com/podcasts or your podcast app of choice. All right, the 115th French Open is underway. We will have champions soon enough. And to keep up with everything that happens in tennis, you must check out SI's Beyond the Baseline podcast with Sports Illustrated executive editor and tennis writer extraordinaire John Wertheim. John is pulling triple duty in Paris, reporting for SI. He's an analyst on the Tennis Channel and also still hosting the Beyond the Baseline podcast. So that is Beyond the Baseline, Sports Illustrated's tennis podcast with John Wertheim. Find it on SI.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app. All right, and as promised, we bring in Ryan Burr of the Golf Channel, hosts Golf Central there, hosts a lot of their Live From programming, also been part of NBC's Olympic Games coverage. We'll ask him if he has a role this year for the Rio Games, either in Rio or back in Stanford. Ryan Burr, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate you having me.
So, Ryan, you're the co-author of a novel, came out a couple years ago now in paperback, called The Fix, which, if I'm right about this, it's a college quarterback who gets sort of caught in the underbelly of gambling and sort of other assorted bad elements that sometimes float around athletics. When we had interacted via email, that struck me just as something interesting, because you don't often see people who are in sports broadcasting, at least on the television end, write a novel. You may see them obviously write their own scripts, which I'm sure happens, even sometimes pen some stories for their respective websites. But a novel is different, and that is what you did with your co-author, Michael Balkind. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. How did, one, how did it come about, and two, why did you want to write it?
Sure. Well, it's kind of interesting how it happened, as it all kind of started with me placing a bet on a college game when I lived, one of my first jobs was in Toledo, Ohio. And I had made a $25 wager on a college football game. And the way the game kind of turned out was, in the last minute, the team kicked a field goal for me to cover my bet. And there's a penalty on the play, and it was on the defense. And what happened was the team that had just kicked the field goal took the points off the board. Because of the penalty gave them a first down, they then took a knee and ended the game. Your classic bad beat, where they kicked the field goal to cover, then all of a sudden there's a penalty. And it just, you know, put you in a bad frame of mind. I just lost my $25 because of this penalty, which took the points off the board. About a day later, I was making a drive from Ohio to Washington, D.C. for a wedding. And on this drive, I just couldn't stop thinking about the game the previous night. And it just kind of all started to come to me as I drive. And I do a lot of my thinking when I drive, probably like a lot of the listeners, and just kind of started coming up with this tale. And obviously the book moves much further than the game, but it was about how know, game could end up being fixed. And as I drove 12, 13 hours, the idea to make it a novel and just kind of the ins and outs and how things, I knew I had something. I knew I had a great story. So I came up with the main character, and obviously how the fix moves forward was, and this was kind of my hook for anyone that I told the story to, was this great college player ends up, as you said, he's the All-American kid. He's a straight-A student. He comes from a great family. He's in a fraternity, and the fraternity on Sundays asks them to pick the NFL games, and he always says no, no, no. It's kind of like, you know, he's the white shiny knight and there's the dark forces. And eventually they coax him to say, I'll take the Bears tonight. And the Bears beat the Patriots and everyone in the fraternity house wins money except for Colt. And this goes on. And eventually he hits like 10 NFL games in a row, but he can't afford to take his girl out for a movie because, as we know, in the NCAA, no one gets paid. So essentially he came to the point where he said, you know, I need to start cashing in on this. Long story short, he obviously wins a couple bets, gets caught up in it, and he has the gambling disease. Ultimately, he's asked to fix the game. He ends up in a game where he's fixing the game, and the game is also fixed by the referee in the game, and they fix the game in opposite directions. And that is how kind of the novel, the book moves together. And as I told people about this, everyone's like, oh my gosh, that's a great idea. You should write a book. You should write a book. You should write a book. That'd be a great movie. So I sat down several times to write this book. And it's obviously, as you said, it's a major endeavor. It takes a ton of time. And I started and stopped. And had almost given up on the idea when I got a out-of-the-blue email from a guy by the name of Michael Balkind, who's a author. He's written several books. And he says, listen, I was at ESPN at the time. He said, is there any way you can help me promote my book? I'm from Syracuse. You're from Syracuse. Help a brother out. Well, he's much older than I am. And I said, the light bulb went off. It's not really what we do at ESPN. I can't bring you on SportsCenter and promote your book. But I do have an idea. If you'd want to get together, I think it would make for a great book. So I drove to White Plains, where he lives, and we sat down, and for 6-7 hours, we kind of went over, and I told him my story, showed him what I had written, and he fell in love with it. So together, over the next 6, 7, 8 months, daily, we would go back and forth, and we put the book together. And we're really excited about it. It is. What's funny is how, since the book has been done, there's been, you know, there has been gambling in sports. There has been Johnny Manziel who's gotten out of control. And every time something like that happens, I look to the book and say, "Boy, we had that before. It really did happen in real life." So it's been kind of cool how all that has kind of happened, coinciding with the book that we made.
That's interesting. How you know, the process of writing so often, Ryan, is it's such an individual endeavor. So when you are writing with somebody, how do you do that? Does one person write, you send it to the other person, they look at it and make edits? What was the process for you two?
That was the exact process, was we would both write, and there were times when we both went in directions that the other did not really feel. And when it was the case where Mike would send me a chapter or I would send him a chapter, we would just be honest with each other. And I was coming from the standpoint, even though it was all my kind of idea and formation, I also knew that without his critique and without his ability to make this happen, it probably wouldn't happen. So when he said, you know, Ryan, I don't like what you did here, I was very open to it. Whereas, you know, maybe if I'm making a script for SportsCenter or a Golf Channel and a producer says, I really don't like this, I might push back a little bit more there than I did in this situation, just because I really felt that without him, I would not be able to complete what I knew would be a really cool thing.
Ryan, was it an easy or difficult book to sell?
I'm sorry?
Was it an easy or difficult book to sell?
It was easy because I think a lot of where I was, according to Mike, who does this for a living, where I was in my life certainly helped sell the book. Our first move was to go to ESPN with the book, as they were just kind of getting the idea of starting a publishing under the ESPN title, and we had long conversations with them, but I think at the end they thought it was just a little too dicey of a topic because of the nature of the gambling and whatnot. But as Mike took it out, he got a great response, and from that perspective, it was pretty easy.
What is the, you know, you're in an interesting situation where whether you're working for the Golf Channel or ESPN, you're essentially promoting that brand. Whether you're on television doing it or talking to media doing it, this is a different enterprise when you're promoting a book. Have you had to, or maybe your co-author has, gone to any book events, festivals? Have you spoken at libraries or bookstores yet? Did you go on any kind of traditional book tour?
Sure. I've done quite the media tour. However, as this all kind of happened when I was at ESPN, the idea of traveling the nation and doing a traditional book tour, that didn't happen. Michael has, but with my scheduling and to your point, they weren't ready to make any exceptions for my day job for me to promote my book. So from that perspective, it's been a lot of radio interviews, a lot of social media and things like that. But certainly Michael has done the much more traditional bookstore signings and things along that avenue.
All right, one last one on this, and then we'll move to the Golf Channel and ESPN. Has this whetted your appetite to do future novels or sports-based novels? And would you, or are you contemplating one around golf, given that's the content you do on a daily basis?
Sure. It's funny. I'm working on a couple projects right now, one of which is a reality show called Foodball, Monday Night Foodball, which is it's actually a cooking show. But it's just, I'm constantly thinking about what's next. And when something pops in my mind, I try to develop to the furthest. And we're actually in some conversations with some different media outlets about making this reality TV show happen. So it's not really a book right now. I'm kind of putting my creative juices in another area, but Monday Night Foodball might be coming to a television screen soon enough.
You got the right acronym there, right? MNF. So you're in good position. All right, let's move on to the Golf Channel, Ryan. You're now, from having been at ESPN, you're now at a sports-specific place.
Yes.
Which is interesting, just from going from a very general general sports place to a sports-specific place. What makes the Golf Channel, in your opinion, a good place to work for a front-facing person, which you are?
Well, it's interesting. So I will be at NBC Golf 4 years in August. And since my 4 years, a lot of my friends at ESPN that have considered leaving have called and kind of gotten my feedback on what it was like making the move. And I said, if your ego can handle it, if your ego can handle leaving ESPN, and when someone says, what do? You're not saying, well, I'm on SportsCenter or I'm doing college football. If your ego can handle you leaving, I believe jumping from the ocean, which is ESPN, where it's so spacious and there's so many fish in the sea, and getting your own lake, so to speak, is incredibly gratifying. I feel that in these 4 years, I've improved so much just because I have the freedom. I have the ability to try things, take chances. And that's really what I've passed along to them. It is different for sure. My first couple of years when the NFL moved in, it was incredibly difficult to not be able to do that. At the time I was doing the Sunday 6 o'clock Sports Center with Berman, he was doing primetime and they would come back to me during primetime for the other news of the day and whatnot. And I did the Sports Center before the LeBron decision. And, you know, your ego is fed by people saying, oh, I saw you, millions of people watch those shows. Oh, I saw you on TV last night. Great job, great job. And when you go to a sports-specific niche channel, like Golf Channel, you know, there are people that don't watch golf. And while we're trying to bring them in, the reality is they're baseball fans or tennis fans that don't watch golf. And while we're huge in the golf community, not everyone, you run into people and you say, what do you do? I work at Golf Channel. Oh, I'm only a golf fan when Tiger's involved. So, you know, if your ego can handle it, which I was able to, and thank goodness, because it for sure was the greatest decision of my life, both professionally and just the freedom it's given me. I tell them, if your ego can handle saying I don't work for ESPN anymore, I think your emotional gratification will certainly make up for anything more than that.
That's really interesting. As a sort of a general percentage, how many people that you worked with did you think their ego could handle such a move?
It's not for everyone. I know people that would. I've had the conversation because it was when the decision came to me. I was strongly considering staying at ESPN for a long, long time. And it came to me where NBC and Golf Channel made the job so attractive that I looked at my wife and I said, I'm not sure we cannot make this move. You know, we have children. They have to go to college. It was almost the money and everything that was involved made the decision where it was like, wow, I don't think we cannot make the move. But in my mind, I was still, wow, can I really leave this giant stage of ESPN? And I almost feel like when you're on campus at Bristol, you feel like the earth revolves around that building, not around the sun. And when you step outside and get outside of that rat race, you understand that there's so much other stuff going on. And that, oh my goodness, the earth actually revolves around the sun and there's other things.
Right.
And once you get out, your ego and everything else, it was actually pretty easy. It was pretty soothing. And like I said, NBC and Molly Solomon and Mike McCarley promised me a lot of things because I kept pushing the envelope because I wasn't sure it was the right move. So we threw the Olympics in. We talked about the Super Bowl. We talked about NBC and doing, you know, being able to stretch my wings within the Total Corporation. And since I've gotten there, obviously Golf Channel now has the British Open. It now has the Ryder Cup. So Golf Channel has grown so much since I've gotten there. NBC Sports has grown so much since I've gotten there that I don't miss those other outlets at all. I can be a Steeler fan, which I found is much more gratifying to be a fan and watch the Steelers than it is to have to sit on the desk and be biased. So I've enjoyed that end of it. And I mean, it still happens. The story I tell a lot of times is I pull up at a drive-thru and I'd probably been at Golf Channel for a year and I'm probably 2 miles from Golf Channel. And the person in the window says, I know you, you're from SportsCenter. This is in Florida, 2 miles from Golf Channel. And that can hit your ego. It's like, wow, yeah, I used to be, I'm down the road now at Golf Channel. And, you know, you drive away saying, wow, that kind of sucks. But the reality is that happens. It still happens because of what I said, that there are people that don't watch Golf Channel that do watch ESPN. I mean, the numbers prove that every week. But I also strongly believe, and I'm 100% behind what Molly and Mike have done with Golf Channel. I believe that in my lifetime, we probably could have all four majors at once. And what I say about golf is this. It is the only sport that is on CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, and ESPN. The NFL doesn't do that. Major League Baseball doesn't do that. The NBA doesn't do that. College football doesn't do that. College basketball, the only sport that is on every network, has its own cable channel, is golf. And there's a reason for that. It has withstood the test of time. And I know, Richard, I don't think golf is in your top tier of sports, which I understand. But there is something about Sunday afternoon, the drama that can unfold on the golf course, that is different than every other sport. It is a storytelling. It is a drama that unfolds before your very eyes, usually involved with the crumbling of a player, much like we saw Jordan Spieth at the Masters, that touches your senses differently than those other sports. You feel differently after watching an NFL game, which is the king. We all agree. The NFL stands by itself. But there is a different sense, a different emotion that is pulled out from Sunday on the golf course, watching a player either self-destruct or come from nowhere to win, that is just different than the other sports. And I believe that that's why it is on every single network. Everyone still wants a piece. CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, Golf Channel, ESPN. Everyone still wants their hand in this sport of golf. And even though I'm now swimming in a lake and I can eat as much as I want, I'm not in the ocean anymore. I found that I like swimming in the lake a lot more.
Ryan, what are the biggest challenges to being a host of live golf coverage?
Well, for sure, the biggest challenge is in a football game, a baseball game, a basketball game, there is one ball. There is one ball on the field, a tennis match, and we're following that ball. When you're watching a golf and covering golf, you have balls everywhere, things going on all over the golf course. I will speak to the NCAA championships where you can't believe what happened on Tuesday when Texas seems to have their spot in the national championship match locked up when their last player is two up with two to go, and no one's even watching that match. All of a sudden, he dislocates his shoulder, and you're not sure he's going to be able to finish because he's in so much pain. But no one's watching that match because in your mind, it's over. Everyone's over at the Oregon-Illinois match. Yet what's happening completely in a different part of the golf course is incredibly dramatic. So the toughest part of golf for sure is monitoring groups that are miles apart on a golf course. And at that instant, that could become the story. Whereas in a football game, chances are wherever that football goes, that's where the story will be. In golf, what you think is the story, a lot of times at the end of the day, becomes story 1A or story B, and it's something that happens somewhere else, a mile away on a golf course, that becomes the real story. And that's the biggest challenge, is there's so many balls in the air at once, literally at once, that you have to be able to keep your finger on everything that's going on.
All right, one more with the Golf Channel, and then we'll finish up with ESPN. And I don't want you to sort of get in any kind of jackpot because you're not naming too many people. But who is somebody at the Golf Channel that you really think is maybe underappreciated is not the right word, but someone at the Golf Channel who does consistently excellent work on a daily basis, somebody who's on air, who you could see over the next couple of years really emerging as kind of a presence in the sport?
Do you mean from an analyst perspective?
Either.
Or from a...
intentionally open-ended, either analyst, either host, either even someone who's like a course reporter or just someone doing features.
Sure. I'll go from that perspective to Steve Sands, who has moved to the network for NBC and obviously does a great job with the golf coverage on NBC. But he, much like me, didn't come from golf. He was a broadcaster first that has grown to love the game and knows the game as well as anyone. And we saw it in the Olympics when he moved to speed skating and did a great job there in the Sochi Games. I think that whatever NBC would throw his way, he would handle it to the highest level and should be on the radar of one of the, forget golf, he's just a great broadcaster.
Ryan, the Golf Channel is the home of the Rio Olympics golf coverage. Do you have a specific role upcoming in the next come August, basically, when that coverage is underway?
I do. I'll be on 14 consecutive days. It obviously is a great stretch for us, where we have the Open Championship. We'll be in Scotland for 8 days. We come home for 4 days. We go to the PGA Championship in New Jersey. From New Jersey, we go straight into the Olympics, which is going to be huge for the Golf Channel. I didn't even mention the fact that the Olympic Games are solely on Golf Channel. From there, we move into the FedEx Cup, which are solely on Golf Channel and NBC, right into the Ryder Cup. But it will be nonstop coverage on Golf Channel. from the Rio game. So certainly it's going to be interesting with all the unknowns about Rio, how this whole thing transpires in the next month, from players that Rory McIlroy has put up the flag that, you know, I'm going to watch the Zika virus very closely. And I think, you know, you're talking about millionaires, in some cases close to billionaires, and how are they going to handle this? And certainly they all want to represent their country, and they all want to walk in the opening ceremonies, which everyone says is one of the great experiences of your life. But it's going to be interesting to watch how this all unfolds. My guess is the golf course will be ready. The best players in the world will show up. And I think that the Olympics will become a staple in golf, because I think it's going to touch a whole new audience. And probably more importantly than that, I think it will touch these athletes like they don't get on a daily basis on the PGA Tour.
That's interesting. So you're going to Rio. This one you'll be in Rio as opposed to Stanford.
Golf will be handled from Orlando.
Oh, from Orlando. Okay, my bad. So all right. So you don't need your passport, basically, is what you're telling me, to cover this event.
I will be in Orlando, and between you and me, I'm not too upset about that.
Yeah, this is the first Olympics I'll be missing since 2002, and it's the news out of Rio has not been good. So I'm sort of leaning towards your thought process there. All right, let's finish up with ESPN. I won't do too much on this, but you mentioned before that you would do this Sunday Sports Center, which, you know, obviously had a lot of connections to NFL Countdown, and you saw the news that this is the last year for Chris Berman on the NFL shows. It's still, having reported on this, it's still a little unclear whether he walks away from the network or gets some kind of emeritus role. But what did you make of working with Berman over the years? You know, there are people obviously in-house who swear by him, and no one would ever argue that he's not one of the founding pillars of ESPN. Obviously, there are others who believe that his broadcasting style sort of was a bit of a relic of the past. But you're someone who actually worked with him, or whether in the same studio or if nothing else, you know, they would go from their show to your show. So what were your reflections when you were there of being around a guy who, you know, obviously one of the most famous broadcasters of your generation?
Richard, I had the chance, and it was by chance, but there were many Mondays when Chris would go do the halftime of Monday Night Football, where there weren't all the analysts and the entourage that Sunday, everyone's in the war room and there's 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 people in there, and he's kind of guarded. But on Mondays, many Mondays, I would do a college basketball game as Monday Night Football or college football, or we would be in the green room, and it would just be Chris and I. And this happened several times where, for whatever reason, there was no makeup, there was no PAs, it was just Chris and I. And I can tell you, he could not have been any better to me as far as advice, as far as just being completely down to earth. And I took it with me for the rest of my life that when I had those moments, I cherished them with Chris, because he was, as you said, he's an icon in the game. Obviously, ESPN in a lot of different areas right now are moving away from the big-name broadcaster and are going to go with a more generic role. I think believing ultimately that it's the sport that sells, not the broadcaster. That's me from the outside, just watching all the movement that we've seen from Colin to Tirico to Bayless to now Chris. That's just my personal view on how they're approaching this with the different times economically and whatnot. But my take on Chris, for sure, he had a unique style. Growing up as a boy, that style brought so many people to cable television. You know, a lot of people tried to emulate him. I mean, you know, he is his own, and there are a lot of people that maybe don't love the way he broadcasts. Certainly when he did golf, it ruffled a lot of feathers, but I can't say enough about the guy. He's an icon in my book and deserves to be on the Mount Rushmore.
It's written very nice words, Ryan, for Chris Berman. You mentioned something about ESPN, just sort of in terms of, and I agree with you on this sense that, you know, management believes, and maybe they've always believed this, that the four letters are the star of the network, not necessarily the individuals who are giving you the games, although there are certainly many individuals who are financially compensated like stars there and who have a different kind of who are treated differently maybe than other rank and file ESPN employees. When you were there, Ryan, and again, you left in 2012, so we're at a bit of a different era in 2016.
Sure.
But did you feel that ESPN or management believed ESPN, those four letters, were the star? Or during your time, were the front-facing people, the personalities there, did it feel differently to you that it was the individuals who brought the sports were sort of what they were selling as opposed to the organization, which they seem to be selling now?
Yeah. Well, while I was there, I saw Dan Patrick leave to go do his own thing, which obviously has been incredibly successful since he's come to NBC and has his own radio thing. I think there's still a place for both. With the whole cable cutting thing, I think in those closed doors, and this is no different from ESPN and every other cable outlet that, you know, was cashing in on both ends for so long, you've got to make tough decisions because the money that was there is no longer there. You still have to pay top dollar for the event. And everyone would agree, broadcaster beyond, whoever your favorite broadcaster is, the biggest superstar in the sport, everyone would agree that it is the sport that we tune into first and foremost. And that's not going out on a limb. And because they've spent all this money on the NBA and the NFL and everything else, the reality is, it is the sport that people tune in to see, and they have to cut costs. And you look at the people that have departed, they are all superstars that are being paid handsomely from other outlets. But I, you know, this is just me guessing. Like you said, I've been gone for a while now, and my guess is you got to cut, you know, you don't have coming in what you got going out anymore, so you've got to find places. And if you had to choose between having a couple superstar broadcasters or having Monday Night Football, I think that's a pretty easy decision, right?
Well, yeah, no doubt about that. All right, one last one for me, Ryan, on ESPN. And again, understanding that you were there in 2012 and the world is different in 2016. But I know that you read a lot of media stuff and you have a lot of friends who are still at ESPN and friends in broadcasting, so you follow this stuff, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. There's sort of this... there's a thesis out there, not with everybody, but certainly in some quarters, that ESPN is very much a left-leaning or liberal sports outlet. Curt Schilling, probably most famously, has put that out there for public consumption, that if you are a conservative, if you have conservative political viewpoints, you are looked at differently if you espouse those even on your personal feeds versus if you have liberal or left-leaning viewpoints and do the same. There are probably many people who would agree with Schilling on that. I think there are others who are like, would say that Schilling is sort of, in this case, just, not that it's sour grapes, but he's reflecting on his own experiences as opposed to what ESPN really is. I can make the argument for both sides, interestingly enough. I know conservatives at ESPN very publicly, Sage Steele and Bob Lee. At the same time, I think Schilling has some fair points in that it does seem that at least on social media, those with a left point of view probably are given more freedom than those on the right. Having worked there and understanding it was a different time between 2004-2012, do you have any thoughts on that? Did you ever feel... politically that you could only say or not say certain things depending on where you lean? And by the way, I have no idea how you lean politically. I'm just asking you that philosophically.
Right. I am a registered conservative, so I'll be up front there.
Yeah, good.
And I would say my take would be at the level I was at there that it would be frowned upon right or left and that you should leave your political views at home when you came to work. I don't think, I think if myself had ever tried to go right or left, I think it would have been vetoed. And I'm not sure I disagree with that. I don't think that is necessarily the place, a sports center or a halftime of a game, for that to come out. So I never felt censored at all. I probably censored myself just because in my heart, I don't believe that's the place, and I would never try to influence or push an agenda. But to be honest with you, Richard, I never saw any sort of censorship from a political view why I was there with anyone. It may have happened, but it certainly didn't happen why I was part of it.
Interesting. And obviously, 2016 being a presidential election year, things are a little bit more...
Times have changed, absolutely.
Yeah, things are more heated. But I appreciate that. That's an interesting answer from some... And I appreciate you letting the listeners know that you're a registered conservative, because that gives you some insight, or at least a little bit of insight into your time there. All right, Ryan Burr is one of the hosts of the Golf Channel. As he mentioned here, you can see him on a lot of their live programming. He'll be on the air for 87 straight days for the Rio Olympics, so we wish him the best of luck in terms of getting some sleep. And he's the co-author of The Fix, which with Michael Balkan, which is a novel about a college football quarterback who gets into some trouble when it comes to gambling. You can go on Amazon and just type in The Fix and Ryan Burr, R-Y-A-N-B-U-R-R, and if you want to purchase the book, you could get it there. And that was one of the reasons I wanted Ryan on, because it's just that's very interesting to me that a guy who's we traditionally know as a sports broadcaster is now a published published novelist. Ryan, I wish you the best of luck heading forward. I really enjoyed this, and thank you very much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
My pleasure, Richard. It's always great to listen to your podcast. I think it's, in our industry anyways, it's a must-listen, and I certainly have enjoyed listening over the last couple months and look forward to the future.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Fernando Fiore and Ryan Burr for two very different conversations, but both really interesting. I always use that word, interesting. People tell me that all the time. That's my crutch word, so I'm trying to get off that, but there you go. I've dropped it one more time, so I'm failing. But I appreciate their time, and both really had some things to say that stayed with me, particularly Fernando Fiore with his talking about being 17 and a car coming for him during Argentina's Dirty War and nearly being dragged off the street by the military. I mean, you can only imagine how scary that was. And, you know, 40 plus years later, still stays with them, and you can understand why. So you can see both those gentlemen, Fernando, of course, during Copa America, and Ryan Burr on the Golf Channel with their various coverage. We've got some good podcasts coming up in the future, including Rich Eisen, the NFL Network host, is coming up in a couple days. Dave McMenamin and Marcus Thompson. Dave works for ESPN, covers the Cavs. Marcus works for the Bay Area News Group, covers the Warriors. We'll have an NBA Finals sort of preview on how those teams are covered. And then some other podcasts coming down the pike, which I think will be really interesting for you, including television sports agents and how the business works from that side. So my thanks to producer Alex Abnos, producer Bet Marston, and the people who support these podcasts, from Dan Bloom over at Panoply, Paul Fichtenbaum, John Wertheim, Chris Stone, and Ryan Hunt. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.